Okay, we're ready to start. I don't know about the rest of you, but I imagine that many of us are in the same camp, that it's kind of difficult to think about anything else other than what's going on in Israel right now. So it's very much consuming my mind and my thoughts as well. And when I was looking at a couple of the topics that I had planned to speak about for the upcoming weeks, I thought that maybe I could postpone a couple of the topics a little bit, that they're not as time sensitive, and speak about one or two inyanim relating to the war in Gaza, because it's just therapy on some level for myself to be able to speak about some inyan that relates to it. Now, the topic that I chose, civilian casualties during war, is certainly an apropos one in terms of a lot of the headlines that we read about in the newspapers. But I'm not really planning to direct myself towards headlines or towards ridiculous, unfounded criticisms of Israel or the Israeli army, because basically much of the criticism, the demonstrations that you see are really premised upon one thing and one thing only, regardless of what subject anybody chooses to speak about, and that's virulent anti-Semitism. So the problem of virulent anti-Semitism, I'm not going to be able to resolve through any treatment of any topic. And the fact that I'm speaking about this topic is not to suggest at all that it really even has any relevance for anyone having to work hard in terms of the Israeli government or Israeli army to figure out what the halakhic approach is towards the civilian casualties during war, because whatever is the halakhic approach, they certainly take the most stringent position in terms of doing their utmost to protect civilian lives, even when it may not be necessary or mandated according to halakha, and even when it comes at times at the risk or at the loss of the lives of Israeli soldiers. So there really is no judgment that needs to be rendered with respect to the Israeli army. Any judgment that needs to be rendered is with respect to much of the rest of the population that would dare to criticize an army that's acting in self-defense after the heinous and brutal massacre that occurred and was directed against the Jewish people and innocent civilians in Israel. I can only think of an equivalent that would be that after it would be discovered that the Nazis had death camps and were gassing Jews to death, that you would have large groups of people throughout the world and in so-called higher universities taking to the streets and demonstrating against the Jews as opposed to against the Nazis. Or if you want to have a more direct analogy in terms of protesting against the right of the Jews to defend ourselves, so it would be equivalent to people finding out about the Warsaw ghetto uprising, and then there would be demonstrations all over the world, not against the Nazis, but against the Jews for staging the Warsaw ghetto uprising. That would be an equivalent to what's going on right now. It's completely inexcusable, completely unforgivable, completely reprehensible, but you should understand anti-Semitism for what anti-Semitism is. It has nothing to do with this topic, even if people say they're protesting that there are too many civilian casualties, they could care less. It's all sheker v'chazav, it's all lies and hypocrisy, as if anybody who's protesting really cares about the lives of the Palestinians who might be in the area. If you want to dub them to be innocent civilians, let's assume that there are tzaddikim and innocent ones amongst them. But the only people who really care about sparing their lives are the Israelis and the Israeli army that gives people warning to go from place to place and to vacate a particular area if there are targets from terrorist bases that are going to be bombed. But I can't say the same for the rest of the population. When there was a hospital that they thought was bombed by some missile coming from Israel, to target the terrorists that they thought may have gone awry and landed in a hospital, thereby killing all the people in the hospital, So if you looked at the headlines in the newspapers, so the headline in the New York Times said the people in the Middle East region, they're seething is the word, I think, because of all of these innocent victims that were killed in the hospital, which they assumed because Hamas said so. So of course, you know, why would they lie, right? Which they assumed that came from the direction of Israel. But then it turned out, based on further investigation, that it was a bomb that was directed by the terrorists against Israel so it could kill more innocent civilians. They said, oh, a bomb directed against Israel that was meant to kill innocent civilians. Well, that's for a good cause at least. So then somehow nobody was seething anymore. You notice? They weren't seething. Nobody seemed to even care anymore about the people who were killed in the hospital. It's like it never happened. No, there's nothing to talk about here, folks. Let's move on. What happened to all the seething? Why wouldn't they be seething anymore? If the bomb came from the terrorists and it went the wrong way, and especially a bomb that was actually launched for the purpose of killing innocent people, as opposed to a bomb that presumably would have been launched in self-defense. So it just goes to show the true colors of the people who are writing the headlines and the articles and staging the demonstrations. But I just want to talk about a sugya. So really here, this is the purpose of tonight's shiur, is to talk about the sugya. The Israeli army, you don't have to worry about. They follow whatever the halacha says, and they consult with all the experts. The halacha says international law. People get up, say, oh, we're just protesting because they're not following international law. Ask any of those people, what does the international law say? Did you ever look at the provisions of the international law? If you really want to write an article about it, say international law says A, B, C, D, and E. So here, I don't think they're following the second clause of D so perfectly. So fine, have a conversation about it, and then we can figure out, is it being followed, is it not being followed? Is it something that can be followed under these circumstances? Nobody even knows what it says. Israel, they know what it says, and they try their utmost to follow the international law, whatever the guidelines that were devised in the Geneva Convention and so forth. Okay, so anyway. I'm sorry, I just had to let out a little bit of steam. So here we have in Sefer Bereishis the story of Dinah who was taken captive by Shechem and Hamor and the Hachivi, and this was a hostage situation where it was an act of aggression really against the Jewish people, earliest incarnation of the Jewish people, Yaakov and his sons. And we know that at that point in time, the Hamor and Shechem came to Yaakov and his sons, and they said that we'd like for this young maiden, Dinah, who Shechem ben Hamor wanted so badly. So the father Hamor said, let's work it out. We'll make a peace treaty between the nations. No offer, of course, to return her, to return the hostage, but we'll make a peace treaty so that we'll be able to get along with each other, and Shechem will remain married to Dinah, and Shimon and Levi, Yaakov, it says that there was some sort of a conniving that was done on the part of Bnei Yaakov. We know specifically a reference to Shimon and Levi, and they spoke to the aggressors in this case about how really, if they want to make this treaty, they should enter into a bris milah. And then what did Shimon and Levi do? They took their swords, and the city was unsuspecting, and they killed everybody. That's the question. So Shechem and Hamor, we know, were guilty. They were guilty of this kidnapping of Dinah, this taking captive of Dinah. So they were guilty. Maybe it made sense since they were the aggressors to kill them, but they killed everybody. And they also killed Chamor v'Shechem and Ohagud v'Icharev. V'ayiko es Dinah v'Shechem v'Yitzeo. So they took the captive, they took Dinah back home. So did they do the right thing or not? Did they do the right thing by killing all of the men in the city? So we know that there seemed to be a little bit of a debate. The Torah tells us between Yaakov on the one hand and Shimon and Levi on the other hand. Yaakov was Shimon and Levi, achotem osi. Yaakov said to Shimon and Levi that you have muddied me. Lahavisheni, to embarrass me and disgrace me, Biyoshe Va'aretz, in front of all the residents of the land, wasn't good PR. Not only that, but I'm going to be outnumbered by them. They're going to come and they're now going to wage war against me and they'll destroy all of us. Shimon and Levi had only one response, which is, what in the world else were we supposed to do? This was an act of aggression for Yomru, that they made our sister into like a harlot, We know what the Hamas did with the people that they raped and the woman that they were parading naked, whose remains they just found today. Should they make our sister like a harlot? So, did they do the right thing? Did they do the wrong thing? Yaakov criticized them, but they had the last word. Except that it seems that Yaakov may have had the worst last word when he gave the brachos, and he said, "B'sodam al tavon avshivel keilam al teichad kibodi kibapam haguish v'yotzonam ikushur." He said that they acted with tremendous anger, and many midrashic sources say that this was a direct reference to his criticism of the fact that Shimon and Levi had wiped out all of Shechem, that he shouldn't have done so. But they shouldn't have done so. The Rambam says that there may have been political considerations as to why Yaakov was not satisfied with this state of affairs. But really, Shimon and Levi had the right to do so. But for a very esoteric reason, that may not be applicable to every single case, probably isn't applicable to most cases. He says that there are seven mitzvahs on which the Bnei Noach are commanded. One of the mitzvahs that they're commanded is that they shouldn't steal. Okay, so certainly they stole, they kidnapped Dina, so that was an act of gezel. The Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Nun Zayin says, Azarasin zui misasin. When it comes to Bnei Noach, every single commandment that they are given, once there is a prohibition that appears in the Torah, that they're not allowed to do it and they violate it, so then they are liable to capital punishment. Every single violation, whatever they do, if they steal, they're liable to capital punishment. So says the Rambam, not only are they liable for capital punishment for stealing, that was done by Shechem and Hamor. They did the stealing. Shechem stole. Shechem gozo. Shechem stole, he kidnapped Adina. By Vehem, but what did they do? Vehem mo v'yadav lo danu. They saw, the rest of the inhabitants of the land saw this terrible travesty of justice occur, and they did not bring Shechem to justice. And since they didn't bring Shechem to justice, therefore they were nischaivu ariga, therefore they were culpable to receive the death penalty because of the fact that they did not fulfill the mitzvah of Vahoshiv Dayanim Mishoftim, that they did not establish proper courts and judges to have a proper justice meted out for this terrible act of aggression. Think of the city of Stone, where the laws were all corrupt, or the Nuremberg laws. That this was a city where the people did not enact the proper laws. The Rambam is assuming that the inhabitants of the city, the men of the city, were sufficiently empowered that they had the ability to enact laws in a legal system if they wanted to, in order to punish Shechem, but they did not choose to do so, right? The assumption presumably would be not that Shechem and Hamor had guns to their heads saying, we're not going to allow you to administer justice. Even the Rambam would have to say, onus vachmona patre, right? That if they didn't have the ability to administer justice, they shouldn't be killed. So here he's talking about where the people of the city were sufficiently empowered, they could have. They could have meted out justice. That's probably not true. In many of the situations that we deal with nowadays, you have terrorists that take over a city, and probably if the people of the city wanted to mete out justice and say, oh, you committed a terrorist act, we're going to punish you, then they would just get killed themselves. Now, of course, it gets a little bit more complicated when you're dealing with a city where everybody elected the terrorists to be their representatives. So to what degree do they bear some culpability according to the Rambam? I don't know that. I leave that as an open question according to the Rambam. But anyway, that's what the Rambam says. The Ramban disagrees in any event with the Rambam. The Ramban in his commentary to Sefer Bereishis on this episode of the story of Dina and Shimon and Levi and Shechem ben Hamor. So the Ramban says, second paragraph here, Ve'ein var halalim halal nechonim ve'einai. The Rambam said, it's not correct in my mind. If really the inhabitants of the land were guilty of something for which they would earn the capital punishment according to the Torah because they didn't set up a proper legal system and didn't enforce its laws, then Yaakov Avinu himself would have carried out the death penalty. He was the leader, and he would have been the first one to illustrate how you're supposed to carry out Jewish law. If the only reason why Yaakov didn't do it was because he was afraid of the inhabitants of the land, he still shouldn't have gotten angry at Shimon and Levi, so they should get a yashikach. They weren't afraid, and they did what the Torah required. Mitzvah, says the Ramban. They did a mitzvah. Rather, says the Ramban, in his opinion, the dinim, the obligation to establish a legal system, is not a halacha for which they would receive the death penalty if they did not do it. Once there is a legal system set up, the legal system says, if you commit the following actions, it's going to be considered theft. And then, if you had any of the non-Jews in that country who would commit theft, so then they would be punishable by death for committing theft. However, just for not setting up the legal system, says the Ramban, that's not a negative commandment. That is a bittul mitzvah essay. That is simply a non-fulfillment of a positive commandment. There is no principle in the Gemara and Sanhedrin of asharasan zui misasan, that the recordation of the prohibition is what would warrant the death penalty when it comes to the violation of a positive commandment. Only when it's an ashara, when it is a specific injunction against committing a negative commandment, against committing a transgression. But here, they simply didn't set up a court system. They don't get killed for that. But says the Ramban, this is on the second page of the source materials already, he says, but you don't need to figure out that the people of this city were liable because they didn't set up a justice system. They were liable for all kinds of other reasons too. If you wanted to come up with liability, I could find you lots of other reasons why they would be deserving of the death penalty. You're talking about the inhabitants of the land of Canaan at that point in time. We know what they did. They were idol worshippers, so they get the death penalty for worshipping idols. And they were people of tremendous promiscuity. Look what they did to Dina. They were committing adultery and all kinds of other acts of incest. They did all the abominations. So why then, if that's true, says the Ramban, did Yaakov get angry at his sons? So he says, Yaakov got angry at Shimon and Levi. Look at the end of the third paragraph. He says, number one, that wasn't their business to carry out this death penalty for whatever other violations they committed. Those violations of Avodah Zarah were not committed against Yaakov and his sons by the inhabitants of the land. Only one or two inhabitants of the land were responsible for the abduction of Dinah. So it wasn't their business to kill all of them. And number two, there was an act of a betrayal because of the fact that Shimon and Levi had promised that if the inhabitants would perform a bris milah, so they'd make a peace treaty, and they violated the peace treaty, and therefore that was the ve'ena bris, the second line of the next paragraph, ve'ena bris ha'shinimola nechsha be'neim l'muma, ki'haya l'hachani p'ladoneim, they were fooling them. And Yaakov said, it wasn't right of you to fool the people of it wasn't right of you to fool the people of Shechem, ki'aviyu b'sakana, because by fooling them, he created a bad name for himself and his family, and that endangered the Jewish people, and endangered them in two ways. It endangered them in terms of the fact that there might be many other enemies who would gang up at this point in time, but it also endangered their spiritual legacy. Ki asu chamas, we're talking about the word chamas. Chamas is usually what the enemies do to us, right? So Yaakov said, we're not supposed to do chamas. We're not supposed to lie and deceive when it comes to the way that we treat other nations. So since you acted with Hamas, ki asu Hamas le'anshei ha'ir, that you said words that turned out to be deceitful and turned out to be just part of a diabolical plan. So therefore, that's what Yaakov criticized them about. So according to the Ramban, unlike the Rambam, there really wasn't any right that Shimon and Levi had under the circumstances. Even if the people were guilty, even if the men spoke of Shechem were guilty, it wasn't for them to carry out the penalty, particularly after they had lured the people of Shechem into entering into a peace treaty. But that's all with respect to the Machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban. Comes along the Maharal. The Maharal in his commentary, he has a commentary, Gur Arye, which is a Perush on Rashi. And the Maharal says something which is totally different. He says that, okay, the Rambam and the Ramban are talking about a kind of what would be the concerns when you're dealing with an individual situation of abduction. What are you allowed to do? Who are you allowed to attack? Are you not allowed to attack? What would be the svara, the rationale for Shimon and Levi meeting out what appears to be collective punishment, which appears to be something that you can't do? There would have to be some sort of a reason. The Rambam says there was a violation. They didn't set up a proper justice system. The Ramban says well, they were guilty of other crimes, but it wasn't for Shimon and Levi to administer the death penalty for the other crimes. But leaving all of that aside, assuming that there would be no violation of Dinin or the Stayin Mitzvot B'nei Noach per se, and certainly according to the Ramban, that it's not the place of just some Jewish righteous do-gooders to carry out the punishment themselves, the Gor Ariyeh, the Maharal says that there is another type of situation besides just an individual abduction situation. When you're dealing with one family and another family that does the wrong thing to them that belong to a particular city, and that is a wartime situation. It says a wartime situation, and maybe this was something that arguably can be viewed as a war against the nascent nation of Israel that was being built up by Yaakov Avinu and the residents of Shechem. But the Maharal says if you have a wartime situation for sure, then you don't have to come to all of these rationales of the Rambam and the Ramban, because sometimes when you go to war, there are the guilty parties, and then the nation that you're going to war against, particularly if they committed an act of aggression against you, there might be non-guilty parties. But when you're shooting your rockets or you're shooting your bows and arrows or whatever it is, you can't always so easily distinguish between the guilty parties and the non-guilty parties. Once there is a legitimate reason to go to war, it's not your place to engage in that type of a discrimination or a fine-tuned distinctions between the guilty and the non-guilty. That's what he says. Go ahead. Look at the third of line of the Gor Aryeh. Ach kashe, im Shechem chata kol yer machatu larog. If Shechem sinned, so in what sense did the entire city sin? That Shimon and Levi carried this out. So he brings the Rambam's explanation, and he says that be'emes dibrei teimahim elu advarim. He says, this is the third to last line. How could you say that? It doesn't make sense. Ki ekshav shalayim ladun es ben nasi haaretz. How could Shimon and Levi have expected the residents of the land to take the law into their own hands to go against the president, the prime minister of their land? This we're talking about not democracies in those days, but totalitarian regimes. You can't exactly take on the premier, the head premier of the land, and say, okay, we're going to administer justice against you. If you do that, you will not end up saving your head, right? Kihayu Yireya Mehem, for sure they were scared of them. And presumably even the Rambam would have to agree that if they were Anusim, the people, then they wouldn't have deserved to die. Even if we would accept the Rambam's reasoning, that's only Hainu Kishiyacholin Ladun. That's only when there is a possibility that they could actually mete out the punishment of Onis Rachmana Patre. So turn to the page 3. The Maharal gives an answer. He says that Benirad Lo Kashamidi, he says that really, maybe the explanation is that we're not talking about an individualized situation, but we're talking about war. And when we're talking about war, jump to 3 lines in the bottom of the Maharal. If you have to exact revenge, it's on the entire nation. So too, when the Minyanim had sinned against the Jewish people, Kadosh Baruch Hu said, you have to go out and you have to wage war against the Minyanim, right? It didn't say you only wage war against the guilty Minyanim, against all the Minyanim. So even though there were many parties that were not guilty, it doesn't matter. War is war. Ein zechiluk, you don't discriminate. Kimen shahayu beosa uma she'asar olahem, anybody who is there as part of the nation, so they are a target of the war. Mutarin lavo alehem the melchama. It's permissible to wage war against them, even though they might be innocent non-combatants. V'cheinhem kolam melchamas, and he says that's the way that all of the melchamas work. That's what the Maharal says. Yes, question.
Yeah, if, you know, we're considering all this, that there was a war, but Shechem came to Yaakov to make peace. And, you know, Shimon and Levi said, fine, go ahead, and we're going to do this. So where is the aspect of war?
It's a very good question, and maybe the answer is because they wanted a ceasefire before they would even discuss giving back the hostage. There was no interest in giving out the hostage, giving back the hostage. So what kind of a peace was this? It's a peace when you're still holding a hostage that you're refusing to release to the other party. That would be the counter argument. It wasn't really peace.
They're not looking at her as a hostage. They're now looking at her as a princess of Shechem.
Exactly, of but course, it wasn't her decision per se to have become the princess of Shechem. This is what they wanted to do with her. But really, essentially, they abducted her. That's really what went on over here. That would be the explanation. The Ramban is on your side. The Ramban says that they should not have acted deviously in terms of their negotiation 100%, and we would have in fact assumed that way. But in the context of dealing with this situation, or talking about it in general, the Maharal gives us this yisod, where he feels that if this is a time of wartime, where there isn't necessarily an easy way, always, to distinguish between those who were the main guilty parties and those who are just a part of the nation that perpetrated this evil or this attack, says there is no obligation to distinguish between the guilty and the non-guilty. Rabbi J. David Bleich has an article about this in Volume 3 of the Contemporary Halachic Problems. The article is about more general issues, but he has a couple of pages that he devotes to this question. And Rabbi Bleich says, similarly, that we don't find in any of the writings of any of the early authorities or later authorities any such obligation, if there is a just reason to go to war against a particular nation, to have to safeguard, to ensure that anybody who might be in harm's way, who's a member of that nation, is going to be protected under those circumstances. And that seems to be the way in which Rav Schechter Shlita understands the application of the Maharal as well. He writes about that in his Sefer B'Ikvei Hatzon. In the B'Ikvei Hatzon, he says, according to this, he says that Hilefamim min amnimna. Sometimes it's really impossible or very difficult. It's hard sometimes to pick out which ones are the terrorists and which ones are not the terrorists. So here he's talking about Sahal. He says that in his opinion, Sahal has to just kill anybody who's in the way. If it's a wartime situation, as is necessary in order to win the war. Schechter says that the idea of a mechemes mitzvah, which the Rambam says includes when you are attacked by an enemy and you have to act in self-defense, it's also a mechemes mitzvah. Part of the mitzvah is to win the war. No point in going out to a mechemes mitzvah if you're going to lose the war. Then you're going to be in even greater danger afterwards. So part of the mitzvah, he says, is lenatzeach, to win the war. You do what it takes in order to win the war. Even those who are innocent, from Avua Begor Aryeh the Maharal, as is spelled out by the Maharal, Miprag, the Pashas, by Yishlach, and therefore he says, V'chein nira nami lomar, and he says, the whole of Amatzav ke'is ba'aretz u'matzav shem b'chama, since we're in a war whenever these types of attacks happen. He wrote this many years ago, but even then there were intermittent wars, sporadic wars. She'en l'skashe b'sakonas nefashah shel yechidim. You also, even though in the process of going to war, some of the soldiers on your side are going to die as well. So he says that's also something where you have to take that risk and recognize that, you know, although normally you're not allowed to place yourself or other people at risk when it comes to wartime, the very nature of war is that everybody is going to be at risk. But he does say that, of course, if you do have a way of discerning who the innocent parties are and of sparing them and not killing them, you're not supposed to specifically target them. Chas v'shalom, lo te'kazos b'Yisrael. You don't target innocent civilians. But he says that if there are innocent civilians who happen as a kind of the just incidental damage, yet to become collateral damage of the attacks that you need to make against the enemy. So then he says that is not considered to be an avera per se. But do you first have to do everything in your power to protect those who are innocent and to give them an escape hatch? 100%. Rav Asher Weiss, if you look at source Hay over here, points to a pasuk in Shmuel when Shaul was told to go against the Amalekim. So living right next to the Amalekim, there is a pasuk in the Torah that says you have to wipe out Amalek. We don't generally have that command, and it's not generally applicable. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was one of the great rabbinic authorities of the religious Zionist movement, and he was the head postdoc of the Eretz Chemda Institute before he was Nifter, Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote a sefer called Amun HaYemini, in which he deals with many of these modern-day shaylos, including Milchama shaylos. In Siman Tezayin, he deals with this question of civilian casualties at great, great length, And he says, so of course, in the first instance, you have to do what you can in order to spare the innocent lives, but if it's impossible, so we don't find that you can't wage war against your enemy because of the fact that unfortunately there may be this collateral damage, particularly when it's the enemy that's using the civilians as shields. What was it that Rabbi, Chief Rabbi of England, Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, said that we use our forces to protect our civilians, they use their civilians to protect their forces. So when they're using basically the civilians as their bulletproof vests or as their human shields, so then it's not a reason for us not to go to war against the terrorists in order to protect ourselves because of what they're doing. But if we can help to protect those who are not the combatants, that we hope are innocent and are not cheering them on and facilitating them to commit their terrorist acts, we want to be able to give them to help them survive. So that's the right thing to do. That's what happened in the war against Amalek. But Yom HaShoah LaKeni, the Kenim, who were a nation that was friendly to Israel, were living right amongst the Amalekim. So Shoal said to them, he sent out leaflets to them ahead of time, right? He said, "Luchu suvu redumi toch Amaleki, leave from the presence Amaleki, peno sipcha imo, lest you end up being pulverized, being killed together with them when we drop our bombs or shoot our arrows. Ve'ata asisa chesen kol b'nei Yisrael, you're good people. Well, you helped us when we left Egypt. Vayasa keni mitoch Amalek." So Keni left from Amalek. So if Asher Weiss, as a tshuva about this, that appears in his commentary to the Torah, Minchas Asher, Sefer Dvarim, and Parsha Shoftim, he has an essay devoted to this subject. He quotes from this pasuk and he says, look, we don't really have too many sources on this because we didn't have to wage these types of milchama so much over the years. When we were in Golis, we didn't have an army per se. But he says, now we got to go to Tanakh, look at the primary sources. He says, we see from here that if you can do something, then you should. But he says, we also see from here that if you can't do something, so then it's not necessary. In other words, Shaul did what he could with respect to the Keni. If he wouldn't have been able to, or let's say there was certain Keni who didn't get out, so he still had the right to go to war anyway. So he brings that as a proof. Also from Divrei HaYomim, because David HaMelech said that he was not able to build the Beis HaMikdash. And he said to Shlomo, I wasn't allowed to do it. Why wasn't I allowed to do it? Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu sent word to me saying, Dam Merov Shafachta, you killed a lot of people, Muhammad Gedolos Asisa, you waged wars. It was a good thing. He was supposed to wage wars. But in the process of waging wars, he had to sully himself a little bit because he ended up killing people. And therefore, he's not on the level. Therefore, you can't build the Beis HaMikdash for me. So the Radak said, what's going on over here? Why is it David wasn't allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash? Because he killed people. So the Radak says, because, Gam, look at the fourth line in the Radak towards the end, Gam b'dmei agoyim ha-shashofach osam, shlohayu b'nei mochamto, epsha shahayu b'em anoshim tovim v'chasidim. It could be that some of the people, when you're going out to war, there are a lot of people there. And sometimes it's very difficult to pinpoint the enemy precisely, and it could be that David killed some innocent people who were not necessarily out to get him. And therefore, that's considered to be a demerit from his in terms of his record. So Abba became Onena Shaleim. But he wasn't punished for that, said the Radak. Why? He chabanasa l'chalos harishayim, because when he went against the enemy, he wasn't looking to pinpoint innocent civilians. He didn't want to kill innocent civilians. He was going against the bad guys. Shal yifetzu b'Yisrael, so that they shouldn't proliferate amongst the Jewish people. We shouldn't have terrorists left and right and up and center and all over the place. That's why he was going against the plishtim and the enemy. About to end of the line. About Kamen Shini's Damin Mo Shvikos Damin, the robe, but because of the fact that there was some Shvikos Damin, some innocent people who were killed, not the main enemy. He wasn't denied to build a base of Mikdash because of the people who were really out to destroy Yisrael. That wouldn't have been a reason to say he couldn't build a base of Mikdash. But because some of the people were innocent, therefore, Minov knows base of Mikdash. That's why he wasn't allowed to build a base of Mikdash, which is for the purpose of Shalom and Kaparis Ovon and Ateris Tepila. So Rav Asher Weiss turns to this and he says, oh, so what do we see? We see that it wasn't considered to be an Avera. That's what the Radak said. Lo nena shaleim. He wasn't punished because it was legitimate for him to kill. Says Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, yeah, he wasn't punished for it, but he wasn't allowed to build a base of Mikdash either. So we see that there's two sides to the coin, which is, it is permissible when it is a less brela, when it is a situation where there is no alternative, but it's not considered to be something that we're happy about. And it's not considered to be something which is good for our neshamos, if we have to end up doing that. And for that reason, David HaMelech was not on the level that he would have needed to be on in order to have the schus of building the Beis HaMikdash. So it is kind of a difficult, call it double-edged sword, if you will. That on the one hand, when I was waging these battles, it's necessary to go after the enemy, even if it's going to be at the cost of civilian lives. On the other hand, you do everything in your power to see to it that it's not going to be at the cost of civilian lives, particularly innocent civilians. And in the event that there are innocent civilians who are killed in the process, although there's no culpability, but it does lower you to some degree from your spiritual level. That's why the Rambam and the Ramban both say, a little bit differently from Rashi, that even when there's a Mechemes Mitzvah, even when we were obligated, according to the Torah, Gzeiras HaKosev, to go into Israel and wipe out the seven idolatrous nations that were guilty of all kinds of heinous crimes against humanity and have to be stamped out of the world, and the same thing with respect to all of the Mechemes Mitzvah wars, so says the Rambam and the Ramban, nonetheless, you are still obligated to, when Kisikra Valir, when you come closer to a city, you have to offer them peace. It's an obligation, even with the Zion Umos, even with the seven the paganistic nations, there was still an obligation to offer them the possibility of peace. And if they would accept peace, so then you allow them, those who want to make peace with you, so then they have to be subordinate to you. Making peace doesn't mean, we're going to have a ceasefire right now, so we'll have more time to regroup, so we can make more rockets in order to shoot against you in the future, and so that we can pillage you and massacre you in the future. That's not what we're talking about when we're speaking about making peace. But if there is a genuine desire to make peace, so then you have to offer peace to everybody. 100%, there's no question about that. So we try as much as possible to do that, to make the peace. We see the same thing with respect to last week's parasha, Parshas Lech Lecha, when Abraham stamped out he defeated the four nation kings who had conquered the five nation kings and had taken his nephew / brother-in-law, Lot, hostage. So Avram Avinu was scared, and Kodesh Baruch Hu had to reassure him and say, Ativa Avram! Don't worry, Avram. What was it that he was worried about? Look at the fourth line towards the end in source test at the top of page 4. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu la'Avram, Kodesh Baruch Hu said, O son, uklasin sharakt. Oh, I'm sorry, before him, the third line towards the end. First line. I'm sorry. Let's back up. Rabbi Levi Amar, the Fishahaya Avinu Avram Mispachi, he was scared. The Omer Tomar Osan Uklasin Sharakti Shahaya Bam Sadiq Echad, the Yerei Shemayim Echad. Maybe there was somebody there in all of the individuals that I killed from those four nations. Maybe there was somebody who was a big tzaddik. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Avram Avinu, no, don't worry about it. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu la'Avram, Osan Uchlasin Sharakta Kutzim Kisuchim Hayu. They were actually thorns. They were actually ugly thorns. And I am very pleased that you plucked these thorns out of my vineyard, so to speak, because they were all guilty parties. Don't worry that you killed anybody who wasn't guilty. But what do we see from this? We see from this that if there really would have been a tzaddik, so it would have been a good reason for Avram Avinu to be afraid. But nonetheless, that the halacha was that he did the right thing. He didn't ask the question before he killed everybody. He didn't say, I better not kill all these people because maybe there's a tzaddik. He understood that he needed to defeat the four kings in order to rescue his nephew from captivity, in order to do the right thing and engage in this act of rescue. He needed to do that, but he just felt bad afterwards, that like David HaMelech, that maybe he would have been lowered from a high spiritual state if somebody there would have been a tzaddik. So it turned out that none of them were tzaddikim. It looks to the Eitz Yosef in his commentary to the Medrash. The Eitz Yosef says, Ulai haya b'neim, when he says that there was a tzaddik, why in the world would there have been a tzaddik? Here, it's not like he was going from house to house and just shooting people indiscriminately in their homes. They had an Amak Shav, they had battlefields. the wars were conducted on the battlefield. Presumably, anyone who was a combatant, by definition, was somebody who was out to kill Abraham. They were on the other side. So what do you mean they were at Tzaddik? They were on the wrong side. They were with the evil kings, and they were in their army doing their dirty work. So what do you mean they were at Tzaddik? So he says, Ulayah b'neim Tzaddik echad she'ibu imam ba'onis. Maybe it was a Tzaddik who was captured. Maybe they took an innocent person, again, to make them into a human shield. So even when you have a situation where they're taking refuge in hospitals and mosques, they're taking refuge in places where they're using people as human shields, if that's where the enemy is, and you have to defeat the enemy, you don't just lay down and die and say, oh, well, that's it, I'll have to let the enemy win because they're hiding out together with civilians. So if you sometimes, when you strike the enemy, it's the enemy's fault that the civilians are being taken down, that the civilians are in harm's way because the enemy is using them basically as human shields. But it does not mean that you do not have the right, and even sometimes the obligation when you're defending your country to go after the enemy under those circumstances. In fact, the Medrash in Koheles Rabbah says that if you're too compassionate, then you run into a problem in the opposite direction. And that was the problem with Shaul, who spared too many of the people in Amalek. He was supposed to wipe out everybody. You remember, he didn't wipe out Agag, Melech Amalek. And Shmuel had to finish the job himself. So look about 5 lines before the bottom of the Medrashic passage at Koheles Rabbah. Rabbi Shimon Lakish Omer Komi Shinase Rachman Makom Achzori Sof Shinase Achzori Makom Rachman. If you're Merakim Al Achzori, you're going to have too much compassion for the enemy, so you'll actually end up having a lack of mercy for those who are truly righteous, because then you're going to strengthen and embolden the enemy by not destroying the enemy and eradicating the enemy to the fullest extent, and then you will give the enemy more of an opportunity to attack you more in the future and to kill more innocent lives. So therefore, you have to weigh your compassion very, very carefully. You should, by all means, provide for that overture of peace. You should provide for the possibility of the innocent people being able to get out. In fact, there's even a mitzvah which the Ramban records, which is that you're supposed to, when you encircle a city for purposes of going to war against the city, you're supposed to give an escape hatch up to the people of the city, that you only encircle it from 3 sides, but the Ruach Revius, the 4th side, you give them a chance to escape. So the Ramban says this only applies to Mechemes Rishus. The Rambam doesn't seem to distinguish, per se, between Mechemes Rishus and Mechemes Mitzvah. And the Sefer Chinuch distinguishes between, says it's only with respect to Mechemes Rishus. The Minchas Chinuch in Source of Yotes says, if you look at the Rambam, in Hilchos Malachim, in Perek Vav, Halacha Zayin, the Rambam ain't a mechalik in Mechemes Mitzvah Rishus. It seems even in a Mechemes Mitzvah, you are obligated to give some sort of an escape hatch. So Rav Shaul Yisraeli discusses this at some length, because Rav Gorin wrote a piece in which he said, oh, we see that even with the Mechemes Mitzvah, you have to give an escape hatch. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli said, that doesn't actually make sense if we're talking about a Mechemes Mitzvah where the enemy has actually attacked you. Because if you're giving them an escape hatch, then you're just giving these people who have shown that they want to attack you and terrorize you the opportunity to terrorize you more, because it's the terrorists that are running away. It can't be that you're supposed to give an escape hatch to the terrorists. He says that makes absolutely no sense. This is an article that Rabbi Yisraeli published in the volume Dalet of the Tukumin Journal. But he says that it does make sense if we're talking about the following context, where and he shows that it's not what the Rambam meant either, because the Rambam specifically says kishitzaron al iel etapsa, that when you're besieging a city because you want to expand your geographical reach, and therefore you're conquering an additional city, but it's not that you're going after an enemy force that came to attack you, that would be subject to a different set of rules. But he does say that, let's say you're going into an area and there are terrorists there, but there are also innocent civilians that happen to be in that area who are living there. Maybe the terrorists that took over the area against their will. Maybe they elected the terrorists because they had no choice. Maybe not everybody should be blamed for electing the terrorists. Maybe they didn't know who they were, what it was, what trouble they were getting into for electing the terrorists. We're not going to go into that. We'll assume that those who are not the terrorists are basically fundamentally innocent, and I hope that they are, that they're peace-loving individuals. Well, if they are peace-loving individuals, so then, excuse me, for those peace-loving individuals, you provide them with an escape hatch. You figure out how you say, look, if you're not armed, and you don't have a history of attacking us, and you're not with the terrorists, and you want to live in peace amongst us, so then we will give you the opportunity that you can run away. Says Rosh Yisraeli, if you can broker that and you can work out a way in which you would do that so that they would be able to get out of harm's way in that fashion, so then it's fine. Look, it could be it's similar to saying to those people, go from North Gaza to South Gaza, go to a place where, you know, the bombs are not going to be hitting the targets, you're going to have a safe area where you can go. It's a similar sort of construct, a similar sort of idea.
Question.
Yes.
When the Torah says leave one side open, that's before any violence starts.
In Milchemes Midyan, we basically learn these principles from Milchemes Midyan. With respect to leaving the side, it says,
right.
And the Sifrei says that what was it? There was Tziva Hashem es Moshe, that they were surrounded on three sides to give them sort of a fourth side that they'd be able
right.
to escape from.
Before.
Right, yes.
But when you have terrorists who've already started the violence,
well, you can't,
that goes out of the picture.
It goes out of the picture, says Rabbi Israeli, if you're going to provide a safety hatch for the terrorists to escape. If you can figure out that you sort of have, let's say that there's a checkpoint, and you say you can come to the checkpoint if it's a terrorist, so they're not going to let the terrorist through. If it's somebody who's clearly not a terrorist, so they will let that person through. It may not be the easiest thing in the world to arrange, and it may be, in fact, impossible. But as a theoretical matter, at least, the very least, Rabbi Israeli says, if you could do that, so then he says that he would agree that it would make sense to do that. We don't forfeit our compassion when we are at war. It's important not to have misplaced compassion towards an enemy that has completely given up their tzelem elokim, their any kind of humanity in the way in which they behave. If you look at the barbaric acts that occurred a couple of weeks ago, so if you have compassion in those situations, then what you may end up really having is afzarius, is having a lack of mercy towards those who deserve mercy, but certainly towards the non-combatants, then you have an obligation to act with a certain amount of compassion. So that's what we are talking about over here. And in fact, the Gemara does say, if you look at page 8, okay, here you have the question that was debated by some of the contemporary authorities regarding the following question. Let's say that by being more exacting, by pinpointing how you're only going to go after the terrorists, it requires that you put the soldiers, you put the chayalim in greater danger, because it would require more of a going from house to house, from facility to room, from room to room, as opposed to if you're going to drop a bomb over a particular area where you know that there are terrorists. You don't know if there are non-combatants there as well, but you know that there are terrorists there, so you're not going to put your soldiers as much in harm's way. But if you do go and you have your forces go by ground to every single room, so they'll be able to make more of an assessment as to which people are terrorists and which people are not terrorists, but they're also going to put themselves much more in harm's way, and it's very likely that they would suffer much more severe casualties. Are you obligated to do that, or you're not obligated to do that? So the Gemara in Shavuos and Daf Lamed Hei Amud Beis has an interesting principle which was articulated by Shmuel. Shmuel said, "Mahusa dekat lakad mishisa biyama lo miyansha." That if you have a kingdom where one out of six people in the kingdom gets killed, so the head of the kingdom, even though they may have put them in harm's way for whatever reason, Rashi says, Vangaria Davoda Samela, they're serving in the National Guard, so to speak, of the king, and being in the National Guard, they're going to be in situations where their lives are going to be at greater risk. Tosa says, we're talking about, well, Mohemes Rishus, that there is this concept of waging an optional war, where even if one out of every six soldiers is going to get killed, so then the president or the king of the country is not going to be punished for that, because that's part of what you have to do. As a king, you have to wage wars. This was considered to be part of the normal course of what was expected of a king, was to wage wars. So some Mephoshim say that one way in which you can understand this is that a king or a prime minister or a government sometimes also has to make an assessment that you put the lives of your soldiers to a certain degree at risk, for purposes of accomplishing the greater good. And if the greater good is to avoid civilian death, so it's okay to give up some amount of life for that important goal. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein kind of, sort of hinted, suggested that this could be one of the things to be taken b'toch ha-cheshbon, to be considered when one is mapping out the wartime strategy, that because of the fact that we do have this desideratum, certainly that we don't want to exact collective punishment, we don't want to cause a civilian death when it's not absolutely necessary. Rav Shem Shon Yisrael Hirsch also writes in his commentary to the whole incident of Shechem that Yaakov was upset at them based on this concept of collective punishment. We don't believe in collective punishment. So Rav Lichtenstein says that you can also do things in a way that's going to be more dangerous to the Chayilim, to your own soldiers, in order to preserve this value to some degree. Not to a great degree, but to some degree. When Rav Aaron Shapiro, the former Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, was asked the same question, he said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. He said that even if you're going to endanger the life of one soldier based on trying to fulfill this mission, this goal of preserving the civilian lives, whom you're not targeting, you're not out to kill the civilians, but you might indirectly end up incidentally killing a civilian, you'll be very unhappy about it, you've taken every precaution to see to it that the civilians can run away and won't be in harm's way, but it's the terrorists basically that are causing the civilians to be in harm's way, says you have no obligation to put your own soldiers at risk in order to satisfy that desideratum. Said Rav Aaron Shapiro, if you can satisfy it without putting your soldiers at risk, without causing any of your own people to get killed, so then that's the appropriate and praiseworthy thing to do. But otherwise, he said, it ends up being a cheapening and a diminishing of the morale of your own troops if you're not placing them as a number one priority and you're placing the civilians of the other side as a greater priority than your own troops. So he says that you're not supposed to do that. And I understand, I read an article by Rabbi Chaim Jachter, in which he said that he spoke to both Rav Schechter and Rabbi Willig, and they both felt that the position of Rav Aaron Shapiro was more compelling than the position that was taken by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Although Rabbi Blech writes that at the same time, sometimes you have to take the entire geopolitical atmosphere into consideration, and if the assessment is that as a result of causing a certain number of deaths, even if it is justifiable and legitimate, because the civilians are being used as human shields by the enemy, and you're not the one who is deliberately causing their deaths, but nonetheless, it's going to spark such a reaction from the outside world that you're going to end up having fewer allies, you'll end up having more enemies that you have to fight off, and will end up in a net sum cost of lives based on the reaction, rightly or wrongly, of the other nations of the world. So says Rabbi Blech, that how can you not take that into consideration? You have to take that into consideration. So he feels that in that sense, that might be sort of an application, shall we say, with respect to this idea of the Gemara in Shavuos. Now, of course, sometimes you also have what we refer to as a rodev situation, where people are running after you, and a rodev can be, even when a person is not necessarily doing it, you know, the kavana per se. We have a katan could be a rodev. You can have a young child is running after you with a grenade. You don't say, oh, it's only a young child, I'm not going to kill them. And the Rambam says even a young child could be a rodev. So you have to look at to what degree the people really are innocent and to what degree there is a sense of culpability. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh, in the whole story of Yaakov and the Shechem, he says that the entire city, all of the people, were actually interested in defending and standing up for their king, for Shechem ben Hamor, and what he did, and they were ready to put themselves out, basically, to stand up for him against the Bnei Yaakov. So he felt that there was that they all wrote for him in that situation. So you have to make an evaluation as to who exactly is a rodef and who exactly is an innocent civilian. Now, Rav Yishol Yisraeli does say, and this is another very important point, he says that when you are dealing with these type of wartime situations, there are rules of war. There are rules of war that are framed by governments over time. And he says that it used to be the rules of war were one particular way. that the rules of war were that everybody understood essentially what the Maharal said. That was the way things worked. You were at war against the nation, so there happened to be civilians amongst the nation that would be killed as well, but that was understood to go with the territory of being at war with another nation. In fact, up through World War II, it was understood that sometimes even civilians could be targeted. You think about the Allies bombing of German cities towards the end of World War II, which was meant to demoralize Germany and get them to surrender. The bombings that occurred towards the end of the war in Japan, that led to the surrender of Japan towards the end of the war. Those were certainly attacks that were actually deliberately against the civilian populations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that was something that was considered necessary and might still be considered necessary even by certain nations who are promoting international law and so forth. If their existential existence was threatened, it's something that might be done. Harry Truman famously said that he never lost a wink of sleep over his decision to do the bombing in Hiroshima, because he felt that put an end to the war and ended up saving countless lives and saving, you know, the civilized world. So that becomes also part of the cheshbon, what is considered to be acceptable in terms of the international law standard when it comes to war. So Rabbi Yisraeli said that is something that we have to take into account as well. So if there was the Geneva Convention that I think in the late 1940s that was adopted with respect to wartime rules, and then there were certain supplemental rules that were added to it afterwards, so that becomes part of a treaty that we have to respect. Like the treaty that was made with the Gibbonim may not have complied 100% with the strict Torah law in terms of how we agreed that we would leave the Gibbonim alone. They were part of the Zion Umos, but once there's a treaty, considers this to be part of the rubric of part of the rubric of Dina D'Malchusa. So that includes not to attack civilian, engage in indiscriminate attacks on civilian populations, or the destruction of food, water, and materials needed for survival, not to attack with biological weapons and nuclear weapons or landmines where the scope of the destruction cannot be limited, not to specifically target places of worship, etc. So these are things that if this becomes part of, shall we say, the convention of the world, so that would have to be abided by, even if it wouldn't necessarily be in accordance with the Maharal standard. But as we saw, there is a sort of the standard that Rav Asher Weiss picks up from the story of a show, that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein picks up from the story of David HaMelech, and so forth, we certainly, number one, even according to the Maharal, we don't target civilian populations, but that we do believe in this idea of trying to save and to preserve and protect innocent civilians as much as possible, and therefore these are rules that, according to Rav Shaul Yisraeli, should be respected to the fullest degree that they can be. But as a number of the poskim point out, it also has to be within the realm of realistic. If other nations would never dream of doing something and they're asking us to abide by a standard which would be impossible for anybody to follow, they wouldn't follow themselves and don't follow themselves, so then that doesn't necessarily, that hasn't been a standard that really has been tested in a way that would make it binding upon anybody, unless it's something that really ends up working for everybody. So you have to also look at the way that it's observed by other nations. But even if they wouldn't have framed that these provisions the way they did, and obviously we're talking about not attacking places of worship, what if all the terrorists are all gathered together in a place of worship? That's not really much of a place of worship anymore. So you have to define these things contextually as well. But the reality is, we could have framed, if they wouldn't have framed these rules, I guess part of my point is we would have framed it ourselves, because it's very consistent with our notions of humanity and compassion and how we really do try to reach out with Shalom. You look at any of these wars, it's the Jews who are attacked. Everyone is demonstrating against us, but we're the ones who are attacked. We're the ones who are looking for peace, so it's a little bit ridiculous for everyone to say, oh, well, how come you're not being peaceful? We're only looking for peace. You have hostages who are taken captive, like Lot was taken captive, and Abraham had to go to war in order to rescue him. So we have a duty, first and foremost, to protect our own citizens and to protect our hostages, and to stand up for the dignity of a life that is our paramount value. And God willing, maybe, I hope, that like Vilna Gaon says, that all the nations of the world will see the godliness in which you conduct yourself, and you look at the tremendous godliness and the tremendous care and concern that's exercised by Israel, whether it's appreciated by the world or not, but hopefully it will seep in. V'yarumi Mecca says, the Gra, V'yaru, they will learn, Yerushalayim. They will learn to fear God. They will learn to have their heads on straight and to have a proper value system. They will learn from us. So God willing, we should be successful at being an Or L'Amim, and this war should come to an end very quickly. We should prevail over our enemies, and we should see peace in our times, and be as God said, it may ever be amen.
This is what not be as